Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Budwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is Carla J. Easton. Easton's new album, I Think That I Might Love You, is out now and is a meditation on community and friendships, largely inspired by the time she spent making the film Since Yesterday, The Untold Story of Scotland's Girl Bands, which at the time of our conversation is not available in the U.S. We discuss the making of the new record, her works as a musical mentor, and some of the musicians who mentored her along the way, as well as the threads that bring us together and what happens when old friends drift apart. That's Carla J. Easton on Into Music, coming up now. What are you working on for your PhD?
It's off the back of a documentary I made on the history of girl bands. So the PhD, it's practice-based, and it's basically looking about how, I guess in simplest terms, how do we make archives more accessible so that they're living archives, so that current practitioners can go and create new work and add their voice to like histories already. So it's really interesting, but it's a long time since I was in education. And I went to art school, so you just kind of messed about making stuff and hoping for the best, really. And this is, let's just say, a bit more rigorous.
That's a very cool project. I love things like that. And so kudos to you for getting into that and helping it move along. So.
Thanks. It's just, I think it's pretty interesting what we keep and what we throw away and what we choose to remember and what we choose to forget. So it's kind of approaching it from like a songwriter's point of view and thinking about songwriting as a means to share histories. So yeah, it's quite a lot to get your head around. I thought I was just going to keep finding more cool Scottish girl bands and finding other demo tapes and stuff, but it's that as well.
Isn't it fascinating when you start searching for those things? Occasionally you find like that missing point where it's like, how did this go from here to here? And then all of a sudden you get that one artifact or something, or you talk to that one person and it's like, oh, there it is.
Yeah, I mean, it's really great. And everyone's always like, oh, why are you fascinated with finding stuff? But I think it's because I used to always raid my brother's CD collections or read his old copies of NMEs and Melody Makers lying about the house. I just wanted more and more and more information. So like nowadays with everything being online, if you can't find the record or you can't find something about the band member, it's kind of, it's a rarity. So you want to know why you can't find it. And then so those moments when you did, like making the film, like find a demo tape and you were like, holy fuck, there's only three of these in existence and it's never been digitized or put online. And, you know, just the kind of, it was like finding the holy grail, you know?
Just for a second, I want to talk about the film because now I haven't seen it. And I'm scouring dark corners of the internet trying to find. But what was your inspiration for that?
Just because I used to be in a girl band. I used to be in a band called Teen Canteen before I started doing solo material or before working with Simon on poster paints. And at the time, I mean, when we started, it was 2011. The Scottish music scene's really quite small, so it was quite clear that we were the only, like, quote-unquote girl band on the scene at the time. And it just kind of felt like it was reflected a lot in interviews, like, oh, what's it like to be in a girl band and stuff like that. And we were like, we're just a band, really, you know. And but then almost trying to sort of find the bands that had gone before you to sort of, like, justify what you were doing. But I don't know if that's hangover from being at art school as well, in that you would always try and like contextualize your work within a wider story or what had come before and what was the journey and what were you adding to the conversation. But again, mostly just from being a music fan. Like, I've always loved the kind of American 1960 girl groups and blew a lot of money on those records in like my early 20s kind of thing. And I just find it quite interesting to then look at, okay, well, what's the equivalent in Scotland? You know, what did we have? What did that look like? And yeah, it was just kind of an off the cuff moment where I was chatting to my friend Blair. And he was like, oh, there's not been that many girl bands from Scotland, but I'd already started trying to find them all. So it was kind of like a hold my beer moment whilst I list them all off. And then I said, oh, I should make a documentary about it. And you go into making a film and you don't really know what it is, the story you're going to tell. All we knew was we had bands to track down and find out their stories. And yeah, the way that we've edited it is kind of to let those stories sort of tell themselves and let themes emerge rather than us sort of didactically say, girl bands experience this or girl bands experience that, whether it's a positive or negative attribute. But yeah, hopefully we were all set. It was gonna go on, I can't remember what channel it was, in America prior to a certain someone putting in tariffs on the UK film industry. So I don't know when we'll get it to you, but we really hope that we can, you know.
My understanding then is that that work also then kind of inspired this record and where you started with this.
Absolutely, because making the film was 8 years of my life, and like I've always been a keyboard player, synths in various outfits. That's what I do. Keyboard, synths, and singing would be like my instruments. And it was actually I'm a session musician for the Vaseline's. I joined their live setup in 2017, and we were coming to some shows a couple of years ago. And Eugene went in to introduce like some really old material, and we just felt it wouldn't be right for keyboards to be incorporated into that sound. So he said, "Would you learn guitar for these songs? They're quite simple." You know, we were learning guitar as we wrote those songs at the time. So I just kind of thought, sure, why not? Because I'd spent 8 years of my life just constantly speaking to women that had just said, yeah, I just thought, fuck it, why not? I just bought a guitar, learned three chords, booked a gig. Sometimes they'd booked a gig before they'd even written any songs. And just that kind of like real can-do attitude. And it's funny because I think the older we get, we forget we can pick up new instruments or learn new skills. So yeah, it was just kind of, it really sat with me, particularly in an interview I had with Saskia from Sally Skull. I don't know why specifically her, but when Eugene said learn guitar, I thought, yeah, okay, I can do this. And then I dragged him to some guy's apartment in the West End of Glasgow, and all of a sudden we're checking out guitars. Bought the guitar, ended up never learning any Vaseline songs on it, and just quickly started writing my own. And sure enough, I still play keyboards for Vaseline songs, but it was really great to have a new instrument as well because, I mean, I'm five albums deep now, seven if you include Teen Canteen and Poster Paints. And I kind of was like doing repetitions and how I write a song and the way my hands would move on the keyboard. So to have this instrument that I didn't know the rules of, so I didn't know I was breaking the rules. And when you're writing songs, that's really cool. You know, I'd show a song to a friend and he'd be like, you can't put a capo on fret eight. And I'd be like, well, watch me, you know? And just sort of, it kind of let me fall in love with songwriting all over again. It was really great to explore those sounds. And I mean, I've always been a fan of guitar-driven records and indie pop, wearing a Teenage Fanclub Jad Fair t-shirt, you know, kind of some of my favourite records and bands. So to be able to do that myself with my own work was really, it was really freeing, actually.
Did that also open up different lyrical things for you as well? If you're working with a different instrument and you're hearing melodies in a different way, and it's like, oh, I could explore this maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. And even just the simplicity of the setup, you know, if I'm writing on my synths, I've usually got to plug in interfaces and headphones or amps and things like that. But to be able to just pick up an instrument and quickly just start strumming, and you know, you're moving your hands in positions that you're not quite sure what the chord is, but if it sounds right, you'll just go with it. And you know, just really sort of falling in love with this idea of the 3 minute perfect guitar pop song again. And just quickly coming up with these structures to then be like, okay, I'll quickly just throw some lyrics down as placeholders and then just keep it this kind of quite simple. It wasn't overthought in any way, which I really liked. It all felt quite responsive. So to then take that into the studio when it got to with the band. We also did that because it was completely unrehearsed. Like we had one day to jam through 14 songs that I'd sent really scratchy demos of them to. And then, when we were recording again, it was like, we're just going to capture this in the moment kind of thing.
Well, I would think too, after spending 8 years on a project, getting to something that's so immediate and it's like, I can get this done now. It's like a relief.
Oh, it was a total relief. And the thing was, we had our one day in the studio was the day after the Glasgow premiere of my film. So it had been a full-on week of like interviews and press and making sure everyone was ready for it. This big, massive premiere, one of the bands got together for the first time in 40 years to perform at it. Like your stress levels are through the roof for something like that. And then next day, cool, I'm just in a room with my pals doing what I absolutely love, which is just making a noise and making it with other human beings. And then the next day going into the studio, and it was just really relaxed. Everyone was having fun and just supporting each other to let's just play. And not in the term of play an instrument, let's play in the way you do as a kid. Let's just like explore.
Oh, yeah, that's huge. No, collaboration was also a big part of this as well, co-writing with other people.
Yeah, so if I think back to like earlier work and when I first started making my music in my early 20s, sort of late teens, people would say, "Oh, you should co-write, you should co-write." And it felt like by saying that, they were saying you weren't good enough on your own, so you kind of do so much on your own and stuff, and you can take your work to a point. And then it wasn't till I was in Canada at the Banff Centre for Arts and Creativity way back in 2017 that I just thought, let's try this idea of co-writing. And now I love it because writing, especially as a solo artist, is such an isolating experience. And the best feeling that I have in the world is when I finish a song. So automatically, when you put someone in a co-writing session with you, there's someone to share your most favorite feeling in the world with, and it's usually their favorite feeling in the world too, or the euphoria of when you're like, fuck, we've just written a really amazing chorus, or and you sit back and listen together, you do it together, and that's really important. But also, I think just as a songwriter, it's made me do things that I wouldn't have ever thought to do, and I can then take that into stuff when I'm just writing on my own, and it's pushed me as a songwriter to develop my sort of skill and craft and really think about what it is I bring to the table. But it's so wild though, because we think back, I mean, a lot of my record collections, Brill Building Royalty, and particularly one of my favourite ever girl groups is the Cookies, where a lot of their songs are written by Carole King and Jerry Goffin. Like, what an amazing, incredible songwriting team. So it's not like this is a new thing, and no one ever says, oh, John Lennon, you're not as good a writer because you co-wrote with Paul McCartney. So I find it quite an interesting conversation, particularly because I do a lot of mentoring work now, where young artists are like, oh, I don't know if I want to co-write, like I don't think I'm good enough, or it'll make me think do things I don't want to do. And but actually, it's probably one of the most brilliant creative things you can do is write with other people.
You know, in what I do, there's not necessarily a lot of, I guess what we're doing in a way is a kind of collaboration, but day to day, I don't get to collaborate a whole lot. But I'm working on a project now with somebody, and it was a relief because we got to a point and I said, okay, I'm just going to lay back on this and you run with this. And then, curiously enough, he did much of the same thing I would have done, you know?
But I love those wee moments, like, and it's different. The way you collaborate with different people is different every time, right? So, like, even for example, getting a chance to work with Darren Heyman from Hefner, I mean, what a legend. When I was like, oh, do you want to try co-writing? I was fully expecting him to say, no, fuck off. But thankfully, he didn't do that. And then, he's down in London and I'm up in Glasgow. So, we couldn't really get together in a room that much. And so he would just send me these little voice notes of him just singing into his phone, like, hi, I'm just in the garden and I was thinking this, and sing it. And then being okay, right, take that idea and then run with it and then send it back to him and then let's refine lyrics. And so it was kind of like a to and fro. And even that's quite interesting as a process because you're having to be quite vulnerable with your ideas. You have to just send them out there, and someone's either going to say, "This is great, it makes me think of this," or they're going to go, "Nah, that's fucking terrible." You have to be quite open and not precious. And also, some things I've noticed with co-writing, I might think is a terrible idea, and I'll just come out with it as like a process, or I'm second guessing it in my head, and someone will say, "What are you thinking?" And you put it out there, and they go, "Wait, that's brilliant. That's genius." And so I love all that as those aspects of it. And yeah, it's great when you put something out there and other people just run with it. And it's really interesting when you do come up with similar ideas as well, isn't it?
Now, the theme of friendship kind of emerged across these songs, connections and so forth. That's probably not something you sat down and planned. That's probably something that just emerged over time based on where you were at and everything.
Yeah, I think that's also interesting as well, like particularly when you're doing an album, because I've been writing, and because I've been making a film at the same time, I thought I hadn't been writing that much. But when it came to having discussions with Howard on producing it, he was like, "Just send me every demo you've got, even if it's just a chorus, even if it's just a melody line, if it's a fully fledged song." And sure enough, I ended up sending him about 47 demos. So I was like, "Where did that happen?" It wasn't like I sat down to write an album, and it was together. Again, it was a collaborative process of selecting the songs, and then you sit back and look at them, and you go, "There's quite a lot from a specific time period, where you were going through a breakup, and that could be a breakup with a romantic partner or with a friend." Like, I sometimes think a breakup with a friend is maybe more devastating, and so the song's sort of dealing with all these different forms of connections, but human connections. And then it was just a sort of like, I'd been researching this idea of the red string of fate, not to inform songwriting, but just I'd been thinking about connections and how do we articulate that and bring that into a visual language that maybe suits the album. And funnily enough, my friend who's a photographer was like, "I've got this idea for a photography project based on the red string of fate." So it was like one of those wonderful moments where everything aligned and came together, and so he did the artwork for the album. But yeah, the whole thing's kind of friendships and romantic relationships and how those things can come together, and the elation when you make a new connection, but also the absolute grief you feel when you lose one of those connections. But then also sort of understanding that all those connections, whether they remain or they are lost, have added up to a point of where you are as a person now, probably.
I mean, the thing you said about, friendships kind of coming to an end, I'm realizing that about a friendship I have now. And it's when I reflect on it, it's like, yeah, I can kind of feel that person drifting a little bit, but I'm sad about that because I feel like we won't be as close. But on the other hand, everything I've gained from that over the course of 10 years, is just going to move me forward because it was a real powerful, interaction with them.
Absolutely. And I think we've maybe sort of brush off the loss of friendship, and it doesn't have to be a fallout. It could just be, the connection becomes looser over time. But I think it takes a lot to like sit back and reflect on those kind of friendships that really mean a lot to us and go, "I will always love that person dearly for that moment in my life and those memories that we created together and how I grew from being around that person and maybe how they grew from being around you and the things that you will have done and stuff." And but in the same way, I think it's more common for us to sort of grieve the end of a relationship, whether it's a partner or a marriage, whatever. We sort of accept that that's part of the process, the healing, moving on, whatever. But we don't really talk about that in terms of friendship,
And it's, I mean, in the ideal state, your romantic partner is a friend or should be, right?
Sure. You would certainly hope so.
Yeah. And I think I've definitely had that in my life where it's like, oh, that romantic relationship is over, and now I have lost a friend. I've lost this person who, got my worst jokes and.
Absolutely. And do you know what I love about the red string of fate theory is like one of the big things is this idea we have multiple soulmates. And those are loads of different connections, their friendships, their romantic relationships. Maybe it's like a working relationship, but it's this idea that we're connected to people like all over the planet and we don't know it. And it's maybe through different lifetimes you're always destined to meet. So if you feel that there's this sense of connection, you should pick up the thread and wind it in. And that connection could be fleeting. It could be 2 days, it could be 2 weeks, it could be 20 years. But just this idea seems to be, we've become very much in this idea that a soulmate is one person and it's a romantic relationship as well. And I found that pretty interesting. So, of course, I relayed it all to my friend Claire. And then next thing I know, she'd booked a tattoo parlor. And now we have matching red string tattoos on our pinky fingers so that we're symbolically tied together in a never-ending pinky promise of friendship, which I love as well.
Have you read this book about it's John and Paul love story, and it takes the tack that Lennon and McCartney really loved each other and they needed each other when they met each other in life. Have you read that?
No, that sounds really interesting.
Yeah, because it's like you examine the things that they were missing when they got together, mothers and so on and so forth, and it's like of course they would collide. And they would have that completeness through their relationship.
Yeah, it's that whole idea, isn't it, of finding your people? And once you find your people, then you sort of, it's almost like you're given to permission to belong. You know, again, to go back to the whole making the documentary on the Scottish girl bands, to me that felt like finding my people and then having the strength of knowing, oh, cool, I'm part of this big connected family. We call it a sonic sisterhood. You know that you know they're going to support you in whatever you do, even although we're not around each other all the time. We can check in. We've got a big Scottish girl band WhatsApp group chat, which is like the most positive group chat I've ever been part of in my life, you know. And that's a wonderful idea, just this community aspect of it.
So taking the record as a whole, the thing that it gives me is like it's about uplift, and there are going to be sad moments, but at the end, things are going to be okay, one way or another.
Yeah, we'll learn and move on. No, I think it was like, it's funny when you go into a song because sometimes you're like, what's the tone? Is it happy? Is it sad? Is it up tempo? Is it like a slow one? Is it kind of like in a minor key or a major key? And I think what was really great, the musicians that I brought into the recording studio were just so brilliant because they're so respectful of songs. So they weren't overplaying on parts. It wasn't about their individual performances. It was just like, how do we make this song sound like what that song wants it to be? And it was really interesting because everyone was jumping about. You know, the person that normally plays live drums with me ended up doing loads of guitar on the album. And the person that normally plays bass with me ended up doing loads of guitar and keyboards. And you know, everyone was kind of switching about and just like, oh, I mean, I'm going to sit that song out. It doesn't need me. That's cool as well. And just to really, everyone was so, they were just really listening to see what was needed and leaving space. And someone said to me, it was like they love the record because it sounds, you can't place when it was made in terms of the sound of it. And I think, you know, when I look back, I'm like, okay, because some tracks have like five guitarists on it, which is ridiculous. And some of the harmonies are so stacked on some songs they're about to topple over. But you wanted that gang feeling to come through because it felt like a gang in the studio making it. And then, you know, there's just great moments like on the song Red Kites in the Sun, where it's just like, oh, I think this needs like a good harmonica. Like it needs a harmonica bit on it. I don't know why I'm hearing that. And then you know, you text your bandmate and they're like, Stevie Jackson from Bells is the best band harmonica player in Scotland. You're like, okay, I think I've got his number. I'll get it anyway. And they're like, can you come in? And even when he was doing it, he was so off the cuff. It was like he'd nailed it in the first take, but me, the band, and Howard Billerman just made him do it about six times because it was so joyful to watch. Like it was like being front row at the best ever gig in your life, just watching Stevie Jackson record harmonica on this song. He was just improving it. But the whole album's kind of like that. It's just, and I think the moments that are the sadder songs, like Never Really Wanted to Stay, That's the End of a Friendship, and Pillars Crash Down, and Even You Might Be the Sun, I think there is still a lot of hope in them. And again, coming back to this idea of being, I'm thankful for what we had, but this has maybe ended because it's ran its course, or this has ended because it's toxic, or this has ended because we've just moved on in life. So hopefully that hope is just reflection, an understanding of why things have to end sometimes.
I'm curious about your work as a mentor. Did that come from, that thing I think that many of us have where it's like, well, nobody told me.
Yeah, no, it kind of happened by accident. I guess like this year is a big year, so it's my fifth solo record coming out. It's 10 years since the Teen Canteen album, my girl band, but it's also 20 years this year since I've been writing, recording, and releasing music. So it's a big thing. So I've come up through lots of changes within the music industry. You know, when I first started, it was all about MySpace. And it was people were just starting to explore the idea of self-releasing, and we don't need labels to do this anymore. We've got the toolkit, and lots of independent labels coming through, DIY labels, DIY club nights, independent club nights that were mixing sort of DJs and bands, and just this real attitude of, if we want to make something happen, we're just going to make it happen. We're not waiting for an invitation. So it was really DIY. You know, like I'm going to put on a club night, my pals are going to come play too, and we'll just draw a poster and Xerox it and stick it up. You know, kind of harking back to the 90s, really, and with this new digital era. And so you come through that, and then we go back into like, okay, well, the digital era is actually killing the industry. How do we do that? The vinyl revival. And throughout every one of my bands and myself as an artist, I've always worked with independent labels that are more artist friendly, and that's also allowed me to retain my rights to my music, which is really important actually in today's music industry. And I don't know if we talk about it that much, how getting the major deal means you're locked into debt, really. Like, you know, it's like a bank loan, and you could write songs for 5 years and they never see the light of day because the label loans them, and they maybe want them to sound a certain way, but you as an artist don't. So all those things, and then I started getting asked up at the University of the West of Scotland, can you come and just present lectures on your career as a DIY and independent artist? But then questions would start happening. How do I do a release? How do I make merch? How do I approach a label? How do I put on a gig? And then in 2020, this collective started called Hen Hoose, which, for anyone listening, hoose is the Scottish word for house, so it's hen hoose. And just this idea of bringing women and non-binary artists together to create opportunities for ourselves, but also for others, and help upskill musicians. So it's kind of that way. I've just started mentoring, and then became part of a community arts project called Rock School, a charity called Rig Arts in Greenock, and that's when I met these two wee girls, Ava and Grace, and helped them become The Chords, and they put out an album on Slumberland, and that's done really well. And but also, I just remember starting out, and especially when it was my girl band Teen Canteen, people were so kind to us in the music industry, like Stuart Murdoch, Eugene Kelly, Stevie Jackson, Jason McPhail from V2, all giving us advice and all trying to help us. And they weren't doing it to get something out of us. They were just passing on knowledge. And I just think you have a healthier music scene if you pay it forward.
You've been listening to a conversation with Carla J. Easton. Her new album, I Think That I Might Love You, is out now. You can learn more about her and that record at carlajennifereaston.com. You can learn more about this podcast and all programming on our station by visiting our website, kmuw.org. Send us your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org and find all the latest programming notes on that website as well. Thanks again for listening, and as always, we like to remind you that our theme music is composed and performed by Torrin Anderson. See you next time.